Welcome to episode 2 of the Foreign Desk's summer series, in which we're examining historical events as the Foreign Desk might have covered them at the time, working only from the information which would have been available to us. This week, it's the Suez Crisis of 1956. Michael Binion, veteran foreign correspondent at The Times, plays a reporter chronicling the chaos at Westminster. John Everard, former UK ambassador to Belarus, North Korea and Uruguay, is recast as HMG's man in Cairo. Anshel Pfeffer, journalist with Haaretz, plays a correspondent recently returned to Jerusalem from covering Israel's invasion of the Sinai. Alex von Tunzelmann, historian and author of Blood and Sand, Suez, Hungary, and Eisenhower's campaign for peace, plays a foreign policy analyst. In our parallel universe, this episode broadcasts on Saturday, November 10th, 1956. Not so long ago, Britain would have felt that it knew how to deal with an upstart foreign demagogue like Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser. Dispatch a couple of Royal Navy gunboats to rattle his windows with exemplary shellfire, then send the Royal Marines ashore if he still hadn't got the message. However, since Nasser announced his plans to nationalise the Suez Canal in July, Britain hasn't looked quite so sure of itself. There have been sanctions, embargoes, threats, and in late October, the beginning of military operations against Egypt by Britain and France. These assaults came on the heels of a charge across Egypt's Gaza Strip and Sinai Peninsula by Israel. It is difficult to perceive this action as a coincidence. Right now, the situation is bewildering in the extreme. Almost as soon as British and French paratroopers landed in Egypt, the United Nations ordered a ceasefire. It seems clear enough that the plug was effectively pulled by US President Dwight Eisenhower, who UK Prime Minister Sir Anthony Eden does not appear to have consulted. What does Britain think it is doing, and is there any way to reverse this embarrassment? What is in it for Israel, and what will it do with the potentially hostile territory and people it has taken charge of? Does any of this have anything to do with recent turmoil in Hungary? And is this the moment at which the United Kingdom officially becomes the junior partner in its special relationship with the United States? This is the Foreign Desk.
Psychologically, the British government has been dealt a huge blow by the United Nations decision to order Britain and France and Israel to withdraw from the canal zone, and it looks as though it's the Americans behind it.
Something that's certainly changed is that we've so far really talked about three superpowers, about the United States, the Soviet Union, and the British Empire, and I really think that after the events of the last 3 weeks, we've seen that Britain actually cannot act alone.
We can see bomb flashes, we can see Canberras overhead doing a high altitude reconnaissance and the Egyptian anti-aircraft batteries firing helplessly at them, but we do not know what is going on.
We'll hear first of all from an uproarious Westminster. Our man on the scene, the journalist Michael Binion, has filed this report.
Anthony Eden has always seen Colonel Nasser as a dictator, an expansionist man who is determined to increase Egypt's influence throughout the Middle East, to humiliate the Western powers, and in the same model as Hitler. And of course, as Eden was Foreign Secretary in the run-up to the Second World War, he understood the dangers of appeasement very well. And ever since Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, the Prime Minister has said that only a firm response will do. Now Eden is looking pretty confused and sorry, and in fact, I have to say, very ill. He's not looking well at all. There are rumours that he's seriously ill and he may actually have to take a break. But psychologically, the British government has been dealt a huge blow by the United Nations decision to order Britain and France and Israel to withdraw from the canal zone. And it looks as though it's the Americans behind it. It looks very much as though it's the influence of President Eisenhower, who has clearly not given Britain the support it was hoping for since this operation started. We understand that Eisenhower suggested that he would not bankroll Britain's debts any further, that he would call in debts that are owing if Britain does not withdraw from the region. So, reluctantly, the Prime Minister is having to do so. He's doing so, of course, against a background of absolute fury in the Labour Party, huge division within Britain. We've seen demonstrations going on for weeks. We've seen the Labour Party attacking the government as a kind of deluded imperial power, still trying to have the last roar of the imperial lion. And we've seen a lot about the dangers of getting involved in an area where, frankly, Britain no longer has the influence that it had some years ago. There are a lot of questions being asked now about the partnership with Israel and France. Was this something cooked up? We were assured again and again that there was no collusion between Israel, which went in first into Egypt, and Britain and France, which went in ostensibly to separate the two sides. But there are rumours going around that there was some kind of secret plot, and we'll have to wait for the view of history as to whether that was the case. Hugh Gaitskell, the leader of the Labour opposition, has been very outspoken.
Only one thing now can save the reputation and the honour of our country. Parliament must repudiate the government's policy. The Prime Minister must resign.
Labour backbenchers are saying that Eden was not only a fool, but the whole party was comprised of fascists and cowards and murderers. Eden has been on television, and he was there on Saturday. Gaitskell demanded the right of reply. Eden tried to put forward the case as to why Britain has gone in.
We cannot allow, we could not allow, a conflict in the Middle East to spread. Our survival as a nation depends on oil, and nearly three-quarters of our oil comes from that part of the world. As a Labour Member of Parliament, speaking in support of the government, put it, to be without oil, I quote him, to be without oil is to see our industries grind to a standstill and starvation overtake the people.
It's not quite clear who might succeed even if he has to resign. I mean, he's looking so weak politically. The two obvious contenders, I suppose, are Rab Butler, the standard bearer for Liberal Tories, and possibly as a dark horse, Harold Macmillan. I mean, everyone thinks that Butler will get it, but Harold Macmillan is an old fox, so he might somehow pull it off, and he certainly has been very quiet in his views over the whole crisis, so he's guarded his powder, as it were. The Labour Party position has not been popular at all. I mean, there have been huge rallies in Trafalgar Square. They have been very outspoken. Of course, you remember that we've had two big Tory resignations, two junior ministers. We had Anthony Nutting, the junior minister in the Foreign Office, who resigned quite early on in this conflict. And then we had Edward Boyle, and the education man. He also has gone. I think Eden might go down as a somewhat disastrous prime minister. I mean, after all, remember, he hasn't been in office very long, and he was kind of champing at the bit, waiting for Churchill to retire. Everyone thought he would come in with all Churchill's blessing and aura, and very distinguished, good-looking, dapper man, fully aware of the world's diplomacy. Indeed, he's an Arabist. I mean, this is the irony. He studied Arabic and speaks it pretty well, and you would have thought that somebody like that would not trip up or seem to get into such trouble over a crisis in a region he ought to know well, but he has done. So if he has to go, which it looks as though he may, I think he's going to go down as a pretty lame prime minister.
That was the journalist Michael Binion reporting from Westminster. The situation in Egypt itself is even more chaotic. There are reports of French and British troops being evacuated even as their oblivious reinforcements arrive. These are obviously fearful times for the diplomatic representatives in Cairo of the belligerent powers, but we have managed to get a line to one. I'm joined now by Sir John Everard, Her Majesty's Ambassador to the Arab Republic of Egypt. Your Excellency, I wonder if first of all you could tell us a bit about what the situation is where you are at the British Embassy in Cairo. As I understand it, diplomatic relations have been suspended by Egypt and they're now preparing to sling you out of the country.
Yes, exactly. What's the situation like in this compound? Dirty, messy, unhappy. There are hundreds of us here in the compound just wanting to get out. and we've been negotiating with the Egyptian authorities, or rather not we, but of course we have no relations with Egypt anymore. The Swiss are protecting power. We wanted to go out in a convoy of cars. Egypt said no, and they've laid on a train. So we're all packing up, waiting to go. For the last several days, we've had a kind of military organization in the compound. The defense attaché took over and gave everybody tasks. Food has been a real problem, because when we were locked in, we had about 50 compost sets for several hundred people, enough for maybe a couple of days at most. We were saved, of course, by Australia. Another great strand in the relationship, the Australian minister, Mr. Cutler, Victoria Cross, a big man, simply came up to the gates of the compound and looked at the Egyptian guards. And the Egyptian guards looked up at Mr. Cutler, smiled sheepishly and stood aside. And he passed through enough food through the gate to keep us going for the remaining time. But nevertheless, it was all a bit of a grinding experience.
I'm sure. Roden Cutler, however, an imposing figure and a good man to have on your side. I know you're very busy at the moment, furling flags, rolling up pictures of the Queen and so forth, and that obviously you can't leave the compound. But as far as you are able to tell, what is actually occurring on the ground in Egypt around you in terms of this military deployment?
We can see bomb flashes. We can see Canberras overhead doing a high altitude reconnaissance, and the Egyptian anti-aircraft batteries firing helplessly at them. Of course, their shells burst some 10,000 feet below the aircraft. We hear occasional bursts of small arms fire, but we do not know what is going on. We're not going to find out what's going on until we get back to London and somebody tells us. I ought to point out that at the beginning of this, London didn't even tell us that war had broken out. We discovered this from the Israelis, who told the military attaché in Tel Aviv, who copied a reporting telegram to Cairo. Oh, we said.
So these reports that we've been hearing here of the parachute regiment tumbling onto El Gamil airfield a few days back, the French paratroopers at Port Fouad, and the Royal Marines landing near Port Said, you are oblivious to all of this?
I know nothing of these events. I have no reason to disbelieve you. I simply don't know.
How much of a surprise has all this been to you in the embassy? What have the relations between the United Kingdom and Egypt been like in recent years? I mean, I know they've threatened to eject you from Suez before. Obviously, we also know that Britain had agreed to cede the canal back. Hadn't a great British fudge been accomplished here?
Well, that's right. What do we feel in the embassy? Surprise, horror, shock, disappointment. For the first time in my career, I think I actually came close to tears, not of self-pity, but of frustration at how badly this whole thing was handled. Yes, we agreed back in 1954 that the canal company should be an Egyptian company under international management, a Great British fudge, and a French fudge come to that, as you rightly point out, and that should have done the trick. It also meant that if all that Nasser had wanted to accomplish was to take control of the canal, he was probably under international law within his rights simply to nationalise it, simply to make a statement that it was now Egyptian property and that contracts of the international staff were not going to be renewed. Throwing everybody out in the way that he was going was simply a bit of political theatre. And it was really to that that we were reacting.
Your Excellency, I do know that you do speak for the government of the United Kingdom still and are therefore probably constrained in what you can say, but I am nevertheless going to prevail upon the tone of exasperation I do detect in your dispatch today and ask you what you think of this precipitate action that the government has taken, especially when it is not clear, at least not to me, that Egypt nationalising the Suez Canal would make all that much difference to anything.
I have made clear repeatedly to my government that I regard this as a terrible, terrible mistake. Yes, Nasser is difficult to deal with, but this makes him completely impossible. We hand him a propaganda coup, and moreover, even if, and it's a very big if, you are determined to secure your political objectives by military force, you go and do it. We said that we would go to Ismaili, that we would take over Suez itself. In fact, we stopped at Port Said and looked stupid. Moreover, if you really want to use force, why not just let the Israelis get on with it? Why throw in good British and French troops? We could have sat there looking pretty and denying any knowledge of what was going on. The whole thing has been completely mishandled, a complete mess.
Just finally then, Your Excellency, as we were saying at the beginning of this interview, you are currently packing your portmanteau in anticipation of being put on a train and dispatched towards Tobruk, I believe. Have you given any thought to when or if you or your successor in the role might be coming back to Cairo?
You're quite right. I'm actually speaking to you from the embassy library with a portrait of Allenby and Kitchener staring down at me in great disapproval. It's a building full of history, and I'm so, so sad to be leaving it. When will we come back? Who knows? I hope that common sense will prevail and that the strong relations that have always existed between the United Kingdom and Egypt will be re-established, and that I imagine that my time now here is up, but that a successor will come out sometime in 1957. Let's hope.
That was Sir John Everard, the UK's imminently outgoing ambassador in Cairo. Do stay with us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. While the British and French military operations in Egypt appear to have degenerated into shambles, Israel seems to have won a stunning victory. Israel has seized the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Desert in a little over a week. But now what? Well, joining me now from Jerusalem is the journalist Anshul Pfeffer. Anshul, first of all, I understand that you are just back from the Sinai, where you were travelling with General Moshe Dayan's staff. We will come to that, but first let's look at the bigger picture here and Israel's involvement in this apparent misadventure. As far as we understand it, why has Israel's Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion been so willing to participate in this endeavour?
Well, initially, from what we're hearing, he was sceptical when the French government approached him early on this year about joining some kind of a military adventure. And at this point, it was just the French. The British were not interested in having Israel in on this. But when the French approached him, he was sceptical. He knew that there had just been signed a major arms deal between Egypt and the Soviet bloc, and he was worried that Israel could fend off air attacks from the Egyptians, who were about to take delivery of new MiG-15 fighters. And the French had to sweeten the deal. They had to offer Israel two squadrons of new Dassault Mistral fighter bombers. They had to also commit to stationing in Israel their own fighter squadrons to provide air cover. And it was only when these assurances were made and when Ben-Gurion had much more confidence that he had this major power, had France, and then also Britain, when Britain agreed to this tri-national alliance, only then did Ben-Gurion go along with it. And his main motive was to try and change the military balance, which he feared was tilting towards Egypt in recent months with this arms deal, with Nasser beginning to create these military alliances with Jordan and with Syria that very much worried Israel. That was what made Ben-Gurion decide that he should go along with France, because now he both had a world power on Israel's side and he had the assurances that Israel was going to get modern weaponry.
As we understand it, the Israeli Defense Forces seem to have won a swift and decisive and sizable victory. They have taken the entire Sinai, in theory, I guess, pretty much doubling Israel's size more or less overnight. As somebody who's seen it up close, what does it look like to see it in the field?
Well, it's actually surprising the Israelis themselves. In the initial stages of the campaign, there were some setbacks for the Israeli forces, but after those initial setbacks, the Egyptian army in Sinai melted away and they achieved within a matter of days control of the peninsula. And Israeli commanders who we've been speaking to were very exuberant, and some of them were also willing to admit that they were surprised at how easy it had been, because they'd seen Nasser's Egyptian army as this massive foe. And not just in the fighting in Sinai, here in Jerusalem, across the city, families were putting sticky tape on their windows in the expectance of airstrikes against Israeli cities. And since that didn't happen, there is very much a feeling in Israel that the military balance that Israel wanted to establish in its favor has clearly been won.
Now, among the territory apart from the Sinai that Israel has conquered in the last few weeks is, of course, the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian refugees who live there. Do we have any understanding at all of what Israel plans to do with Gaza now that it has it?
Israel wanted to go into the Gaza Strip and destroy what they call the Fedayun, or the infiltrators' bases. These are Palestinians, groups directed and supplied by the Egyptian military, who have been carrying out in recent years attacks on Israeli towns and villages and farms in southern Israel. And this was a major objective as far as Israel was concerned. We know now that for France and for Britain, the main objective has been the Suez Canal. But Israel's objectives were much closer to home. There were these bases or groups in Gaza operating against Israeli civilian targets. And Israel wanted to go in and destroy those bases. But as you said, now Israel is in control of Gaza. It's a large Palestinian civilian area, hundreds of thousands of people living there. And there is no real idea in Israel what to do with those people. They don't want to see Egypt back in control, but they don't want to control them either. And that's the question mark that's being talked about in private, but nobody in public is speaking about it.
If we apply the same question to the Sinai, and as you said, Israel seems quite surprised to find itself in possession of it with such relative ease. Is there any talk as yet about what Israel wants to do with it? Is it going to keep the Sinai forever as part of some greater Israel, or might it perhaps serve as leverage as part of some sort of future peace settlement?
Well, we've seen Ben-Gurion totally swept away. He's usually a very pragmatic leader. But he gave a speech the other day talking about the third kingdom of Israel. You're using these biblical terms of a return to Mount Sinai, where the Jews 3,000 years ago received their Torah. I mean, this is, quite frankly, almost unhinged talk from Ben-Gurion. He's usually quite a grounded leader talking in these terms. I think he's been swept away. Calmer heads have been saying that there's no way that Israel will be able to hold onto the entire Sinai Peninsula. And people in very high offices have been telling me that they know there will have to be some kind of retreat. The plan is, or the hope is, that part of the negotiations, there'll be assurances for freedom of navigation through the Tiran Straits. But right now, people in power here in Israel are just really swept away by this incredible Israeli dominance of Sinai. I know that in Britain and in France, the feeling is this hasn't been a successful war at all. Here in Israel, the feeling right now, this has been a huge success, and they're looking to exploit that.
Anshul Pfeffer in Jerusalem, thank you for joining us. Finally on today's programme, I'm joined by the foreign policy analyst Alex von Tunzelmann. Alex, it has been an eventful few months on a number of fronts, but most obviously along the Suez Canal. From where we are now in November of 1956, how does this expedition look to you on the spectrum at which one end is, say, Great Britain, a great world power undertaking legitimate action to protect its interests, and at the other end, a slightly bizarre act of desperate post-imperial hubris?
Well, Andrew, it looks increasingly close to the bad end of that spectrum. I mean, I think the kind of course of events over the last few weeks, I mean, over the whole summer, of course, we've had Britain and France rattling their sabres about the Suez Canal and so on. But what we thought we had just a few weeks ago was a solution at the United Nations. And then all of a sudden, we had this Israeli invasion of Egypt that sort of popped up, and Britain and France suddenly jumping in, saying that they were being peacekeepers. And this very, very confusing sequence of events where it quickly became apparent that actually that was quite a difficult claim to make. It seems certainly from the outside, and of course, this is the 1950s, everybody's very honourable, we don't want to accuse people of lying, but it certainly seems like perhaps the full truth has not been told at every point.
What do we understand about the intercession in this by US President Dwight Eisenhower? It very much appears as if we've seen the United States calling the United Kingdom to heel. Can that really be possible?
Well, it does look very much like that, and particularly over the issue of oil, which has become a really serious issue between the US and the UK at this point. I mean, what seems to have been the case is that Britain's dollar reserves are very, very low. And when oil has been very much limited by the fact that this conflict has blocked the Suez Canal, Britain simply does not have any oil that it can buy, because the oil that it can buy priced in pounds is all being shipped through the Suez Canal. So the only oil available to Britain to buy has been oil from the United States, which of course is priced in dollars. And what we know is that Eisenhower has refused to price that in pounds to help Britain out. So effectively, that's clearly part of what has forced Britain into this climb down. And that seems like a pretty extraordinary level of intervention from the United States, certainly not something that speaks of this special relationship that we've heard so much about.
Is it weird, just developing that point further, that President Eisenhower has seemed almost theatrically indifferent to the United Kingdom's predicament? We have the bizarre situation where just a few days ago we had Anglo-French forces actually landing at Port Said. We had a UN ceasefire then dropped on top of them within 48 hours. And we now literally have British forces in Egypt not knowing whether they're coming or going.
Absolutely. And I mean, certainly what we're hearing from Washington is that Eisenhower has been tremendously angry about this whole thing. It's pretty clear from the outside that Britain moved without consulting or even informing the United States. And certainly reports we're hearing from Washington of the corridors of the White House echoing with the words perfidious Albion do not speak well of what will happen next in that relationship.
We heard last weekend that, as far as it's possible to tell, the Soviet Union has undertaken a large-scale invasion of Hungary. Within the last few days, it is reported that Budapest is now completely under Soviet control. Is there a relationship between those events in Hungary and those events we're seeing in Egypt?
The Hungarians seem to have had a sort of independent uprising inspired a bit by what has happened in Poland recently, sort of defiance of the Soviet Union. And it appears that certainly the Soviets have been alleging that that has been caused by the Americans, but actually there seems to be very little evidence that that's the case. In fact, that seems to have been a spontaneous Hungarian uprising. And of course, the fact that it's coincided with these events in the Middle East have really caused some serious fears about this war escalating. However, what appears to have happened is that the Soviets have, after various manoeuvres, they do indeed appear to have cracked down very, very hard on Hungary. And of course, one of the problems there is that I think many in the West would have wished, potentially under other circumstances, to see if there were ways that they could come to Hungary's aid. And because the attention has been so much on the Middle East, there just has really been no possibility of that at all.
Does it seem to you that the events in Suez are the kind of thing of which serious ramifications will be made, or will this be remembered decades hence as a sort of strange comic opera interlude which frankly blew over more or less reasonably quickly?
Well, I think a lot will depend on what comes out, which we still don't know, about this question of collusion between Britain and France and Israel. Now, obviously, these are rumours. These are being fiercely denied by the British government, at least. However, we are hearing more and more rumours that do seem to fit the facts of the case that imply that, in fact, there was a plan to do this from the start. And I think whatever emerges about that in good time will certainly inform a long-term reaction about it.
Just as a final thought then, Alex, embarrassing as this entire episode clearly has been for the United Kingdom, can we at least draw some comfort from the knowledge that valuable salutary lessons will have been absorbed about the folly of impetuous military misadventures in the Middle East?
I don't know if this will resolve terribly easily. What I do think is now the case is that something that's certainly changed is that we've so far really talked about three superpowers, about the United States, the Soviet Union, and the British Empire. And I really think that after the events of the last 3 weeks, we've seen that Britain actually cannot act alone. And so I think we're now living in a bipolar world, just two superpowers left.
Alex von Tunzelmann, thank you for joining us here on the Foreign Desk. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week with the next installment of our summer series, which looks at the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. And keep an eye out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle, Christy Evans, and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, our researcher. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.